Our next case is 12-1866, Peggy Spaeth versus State Auto Mutual Insurance Company et al. For the appellee, we have Sean Maestel. The appellant.
Madam Chief Justice, Associate Justices, may it please the court, Sean Maestel on behalf of Cincinnati Insurance. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. An individual's domicile is a question which permeates many facets of everyday life. Yesterday's voting was determined, where you may vote was determined by your domicile. Where your children go to school is determined by the parents' domicile. Where you pay taxes is determined by your domicile. Where individuals get divorced is determined by your domicile.
How many domiciles does an individual have?
One, unlike appellees claimed in this case, where they claimed originally you could have more than one.
Where could I find authority for an individual only having one domicile?
Sturgeon versus Corte.
Pardon me, please?
Sturgeon versus Corte, 1878, where this court held that it adopted from English law that only one domicile could have.
So an individual can have multiple residences, but only one domicile.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And what, in your view, are the factors that we should weigh in determining where where his domicile was?
Well, I think we have to go to the original decision for this court. It's 1878 in Corte, and take a look at that decision where this court looked at stated three things. We look at the intention of the individual, we look to where he selected his permanent place of abode to be, and we look at where he chooses to reside permanently. And when we take those three things, when we look at that, we then couple it with factum. Is his animus, the intent that I just stated, does it match up with the facts in the case?
Nothing's changed since 1878?
No.
Pretty much the same,
Your Honor. In fact, in Coleman, which was a 1972 case from this court, which is a divorce case, it was really interesting because the court said only the individual knows where his actual domicile is.
Well, the tax man seems to know when you move to Florida, and that's really what was going on here, wasn't it? Is this individual, in order to take advantage of favorable tax treatment, established his residency. I don't know what they call it in Florida. Do they call it domicile, or do they call it you're a Florida resident?
Well, to get
advantage of the better tax treatment and those kinds of things. No income tax, right?
I believe that's accurate, Your Honor.
No estate tax. And the record, which you lay out a lot of facts about all the connections with Florida, would indicate that this individual, your insured, or the policyholder, had done all of those things to make himself a Florida resident for tax purposes.
Wait.
But as Justice O'Donnell's inquiry implies, in 1878, there weren't too many people living in two places or having two or three homes scattered around the country or around the world.
Well, Your Honor, it's more
they were still getting around on horseback and train at that point.
That may be accurate, Your Honor, but again, Mr. Schill testified there was many reasons he moved permanently to Florida with his wife.
Well, let me ask you a fundamental question here. This case seems to be, your brief leads out with a ton of facts which favor your point of view, and they seem to, but isn't this case just very fact specific? I mean, what new do we provide for lawyers and judges
What new you could provide by this case is a succinct opinion that states that when you selected intention, when you looked at the intent of the individual, as you did not just in 1878, but in 1972, and again in 2009 in State X Rel Houston, where this court said that the Secretary of State made a mistake where they failed to take into account Mr. Houston's intent on having a domicile other than what they indicated. The Court of Appeals here refused to look at intent at all. They refused to apply the accurate law. And they did so even though all the law has said that the paramount inquiry is intent. In State X Rel Houston, the Secretary of State was reversed on the domicile analysis, and that was just 4 years ago, on the basis of the fact that they ignored the unequivocal intent of the individual. Here, there are no facts that show that Mr. Shill's intent was other than since 1993 to be domiciled in Florida. In fact, you take a look at the Court of Appeals opinion.
Well, I don't want to come back to these interchangeable words. In Florida, for the purposes that he's crossed all these hoops and paid close attention to how much time he spends in Florida, all those things you have to do, is it a domicile question or is it a residency question under Florida law?
Under Florida law, I don't know, Your Honor. The question is whether or not the legal residence at domicile, which is the legal definition that this state has recognized over 125 years, requires that intent be the paramount factor. And with all due respect, I believe that the issue between the states.
Well, do they mean the same thing?
Residency. Residency in Ohio.
And domicile mean they are interchangeable words or not?
In Ohio, depending on what opinion you read, residency and domicile, in fact, has been footnoted as being interchangeable. But the question is not just between states, though. It could be between townships. The issue is, when you have an individual say, as several courts have then said, that there's a presumption created. In 1949, in the 12th District, looking at this court's decisions, in Seyfeld said, there's a presumption that gets created when the intent is that I'm domiciled somewhere. In 1982, in Langenfeld, which is an 8th District decision, they said a presumption is created when the individual says his intent is, I currently reside here. There was no discussion at all in the 8th District's opinion about the fact that in 2008, when this accident occurred, Mr. Shill's intent, which is unequivocated in this record, was that he was a domicile of Florida for whatever purpose.
Point. It's clear from your facts he intended to be a resident of Florida. I'm less certain what he intended or even thought about in terms of the terms of domicile. Let me ask you this. If he had had an accident with his car in Ohio, what does the policy provide as to disputes? What law? Does Florida law apply or does Ohio law
with regard
apply?
To the interpretation of the contract, I don't think there's any agreement. I don't know per se exactly what's in the contract, but it's an Ohio policy. Okay, and the question is the legal residence a domicile?
That really isn't the question, though, Mr. Mestel, because on page 5 of the insurance contract, the issue becomes who is an insured, and in answer to Justice Pfeiffer's question, James would be an insured under this policy if he were involved, but the issue in this case is whether a resident relative is an insured.
Well, and I apologize.
And on page 5 of the contract, it says a person is a resident relative if he is related to you by blood, who is a resident of your household, and whose legal residence of domicile is the same as yours.
Correct.
So we are really looking at the issue of whether Robert's domicile is the same as James's domicile.
That's the legal.
And that is the legal issue that we're looking at in trying to interpret what this contract means as to whether there is coverage for Robert involved in this accident. Isn't that the issue?
You're correct, Justice O'Donnell. With regard to Justice Pfeiffer, yes, under that circumstance, because the policy is an umbrella policy, it covers Mr. Shill anywhere in the world. With regard to Robert's domicile, he has always been an Ohio domicile. There's no question that he's never been in Florida. But James Schill, all the evidence and all the intent that is evidenced in this record shows that he was, since 1993, domiciled in Florida. And it's notable that the appellate court it stops its analysis in 1993. 15 years went by between 1993 and 2008, where the presumption, the problem here is the presumption. The Court of Appeals states that in 1993, we're going to presume that you're domiciled in Ohio. The accident doesn't occur until 2008. What happened in those 15 years? Well, we know what happened because it's unequivocal in the record that Mr. Schill left Ohio. He left Ohio to be permanently domiciled in Florida.
But he
returns.
But James returns to Ohio, does he not? And Justice Pfeiffer's point, I think, is he spends a considerable portion of time here because he has a business in Ohio, right?
Correct.
And he returns to the residence where Robert resides.
He returns there, but he's never resided there as a permanent residence. But the question is, what is his intent?
Well, now you're getting us all confused.
I'm sorry, James Schill.
Two Schills.
James Schill is the father.
They're not Schills, actually. That's their name. We have James and Robert.
James didn't move from the Burton address to Florida. They had a separate house. He moved with his wife to Florida.
Okay.
In 1993, okay? The issue, though, is those are all facts, okay, which look to the factum, okay? But there's been no discussion at all about the intent.
Counsel, can you clarify? You've referred to the factual determination here at the trial court. Did we have cross motions for summary judgment? So in the trial court, was your position that there were no factual disputes remaining? What was your position in the trial court if you were moving for summary judgment there?
Well, we were moving for summary judgment on the basis that, again, the twofold. One, they were claiming that there was two domiciles. We're saying you could only have one, and Florida is it. And we moved for summary judgment on the basis that his intent was that he was always domiciled in Florida since 1993. And therefore, we were entitled to summary judgment because there was no material issue of fact on that issue.
Well, if we agree with you that this is a factual determination, and that's what we write as a proposition of law, do we send it back then? Is the most you can get a remand for a factual determination?
That's not the most I can get. That should be the least I get. The most I can get is what I should get, and that's the fact that the intent is the paramount inquiry.
But isn't there a factual determination as to the intent?
No, because in the record, there is no dispute as to his intent.
So, but you've submitted facts. You don't believe that there is a dispute as to a material fact because you're the only one who's submitted facts as to his intent. So there's no factual, it's not that there isn't a factual question, it's that there's no factual question remaining for the trial court to decide because it's undisputed.
His intent is undisputed.
Gotcha. Okay.
And the facts that you use to bolster that intent are undisputed.
Yes.
And you believe that the facts support an application of court.
Coleman and State X Rel Houston as well.
Especially if you take but you have to, in order to meet those standards, talk about intent. And that's the problem you have with the Court of Appeals decision.
Majority problem, yes.
But I'm having trouble because I'm looking at the Court of Appeals decision, and they obviously made the decision that's being appealed here. And I'm troubled by this idea that James flunked retirement. That seems to go throughout the opinion. He didn't own a residence in Florida. He spent, it appears to me, at least half his time in Ohio, and he never filed anything acknowledging where he was born and raised, where his business is located, and where his children live is not his domicile. How do you overcome that burden?
Because we look at his intent, Your Honor. In the 11th District Court of Appeals decision in Warren versus Rabin, they talked about the fact that this is not a battle of the forms.
It's not what?
It's not a battle of the forms. We don't look at pieces of documents to determine where you're domiciled. We look primarily to your intent. And where your intent shows where a justice might move to Columbus for an interim period of time for their elected office or for permanency.
Was I domiciled in Columbus last night, although I live in Geauga County?
I would say that's depending on your intent, Your Honor.
I'm going back to Geauga County tonight.
Well, then you're temporarily away from your permanent home is what you're
telling
me.
So what about James, though, who still owns his home in Chardon, Ohio?
James does not own any homes in Ohio. Robert Schill, along with Jean Schill, Robert's mother, owned the house in Ohio. James Schill has never owned any property in Ohio.
Is there a presumption, because he was born in Ohio, that the burden shifts to for him to prove that he now is domiciled in Florida? I mean, is that birthplace that significant?
I believe that's what the 8th District decision says. I don't believe that's what this law, the Ohio Supreme Court, has said. The issue is you're presumed domicile, because until you reach the age of majority, you have no legal capacity to choose your domicile. Upon your 18th birthday, you now have the legal capacity to choose domicile. You can form intent. Mr. Schill, born in Ohio, okay, but in 1993, he had the intent as a 60-some-year-old man to move to Florida.
Is Mr. James Schill, a property owner in the state of Florida?
No, not to my knowledge.
So let me also ask: Is it Mrs. Spaeth?
Correct.
She did not cross appeal in this matter.
No, Your Honor. That's why we also believe that there are issues that we presume they'll raise about ambiguity of the policy. The Court of Appeals found it.
Ambiguity. It would have to be to the word domicile. Correct.
Correct. And we believe that for 125 years, all Ohio courts have consistently defined the word domicile. And even if
but she didn't raise that in a cross appeal.
They did not, and the Court of Appeals found at paragraph 22 that the statement that domicile was not ambiguous.
Yes. So.
So we believe that's not before the court.
The definition of domicile is not ambiguous, but how they applied the facts as it relates to Mr. Schill is the crux here, obviously. And they didn't look to intent, though, which is part of the definition of domicile.
It's the majority definition of domicile.
So, you know, that's, even though domicile, it's not ambiguous as to what it is, what it means, your argument here is that it was misapplied.
Misapplied, and if we look at the presumption that should have been applied, James Schill should have been presumed to be in 2008, since 1993, a Florida domicile. Then the burden shifts.
What's that presumption based on?
His two depositions, his affidavit, all his tax returns, his fact that his wife.
So all the facts that he lives there with his wife, he goes to church there, he's registered to vote, all of the
Florida
facts
driver's
that
license.
You have laid out there. Or what you say is demonstrative of intent.
It buttresses his intent.
Coupled with his affidavit, and there's no countervailing information. His son never testified that Dad considers Ohio his home, did he?
No, he did not. Robert Schill, his deposition is in the record, and he said that his dad is only up 10 days, approximately a month, to take care of his businesses, which I would note his business is actually owned by the Ohio Family Limited Partnership, not by Mr. Schill personally.
He's an employee of that business.
No, that's not. He is not an employee of the business. He gets a K-1. Actually, the K-1 is issued to the Schill Family Limited Partnership,
okay,
which is an Ohio entity, which is separate and distinct from whether or not James Schill is an Ohio domicile.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Keefe?
Madam Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. The Court of Appeals most certainly did look at the intent of James Schill and the operative facts of that intent coupled with his conduct. And his stated subjective intent is to remain in Ohio for up to 2 weeks or more for the rest of his life, where he's held a domicile for his entire life. He wasn't just presumed domicile based on his birth here, or turning 18 and still being here. He raised his family here. He put them through school here. He was an Ohio CPA here. And since the 70s, he's owned large rubber extrusion companies out in Geauga County, Ohio. He never plans on retiring. He thought he wanted to retire, but it never happened.
Why does that matter, that he never plans on retiring? In this day and age, you don't have to. I mean, there's so much ability to transport yourself in this country, you know, within a matter of hours. What difference does that make, that he's not retired?
The concept of domicile, and one's domicile once fixed, it remains until you abandon it. okay? And that is both from the Corte case in 1878 and then the Hudson case.
But you agree intent is determinative here.
It's an objective intent standard that combines intent plus conduct. And the big concern here is that they're advocating a standard based on one's subjective intent known only to that individual. And what we're dealing with here is a contract, okay?
Well, now it's, are the words domicile and residence interchangeable or not?
According to the Corte case, they are.
All right, so it's pretty clear that he intended to be a Florida resident for tax purposes.
If he were going to be a Florida resident for tax purposes, our Ohio legislature says he has to file an affidavit with the Department of Taxation to that effect. He's an Ohio CPA. He knew of that requirement. He never did that here. His stated intent, once again,
well, does
is
that
to
mean that he doesn't get the benefit of the tax that he thought he was going to?
That's for the Department of Taxation.
Well, is there any evidence that they are not treating him as a Florida resident for tax purposes in Ohio?
The fact that they haven't pursued Mr. Schill is irrelevant. If we say there's one domicile for all purposes, we have to look at the legislative test for domicile. To avoid an Ohio presumed domicile, you have to file the affidavit or you are
that's
presumed.
For that's only for tax purposes.
But if we can only have one domicile for all purposes, tax purposes, let's get back to what the real purpose is here, the contract. The intent of the parties is presumed to reside in the contract. This court has reiterated that again and again and again.
And what's the basis in the contract that you think indicates that his intent was to be an Ohio-domiciled individual?
Well, it's the intent of the parties and the insurance company who issued the policy to him as an Ohio-named insured living at the Ohio home.
But he isn't the issue here. Robert is the issue. The question is whether Robert is a resident relative of James in residing in that household. Isn't that the question?
I agree with you, Justice O'Donnell, and here's how we get there. We have a company that issues an Ohio policy containing only Ohio coverages. The word Florida doesn't appear once. The only policy that serves as underlying to it is the Ohio homeowners. So in these residency cases, when we have to ask, we say, is Bobby also at this home? Is Jimmy also at this home? Or in our case, is Robert also at this home that was insured under this policy? The unequivocal answer is yes. There's no dispute that Robert lived at that home at all times. But the insurance policy is issued as an Ohio policy. It has
Can I ask a question along that? That troubles me from your opposing counsel. The Ohio house that is being referred to by the 8th District Court of Appeals, I'm finding that James provides financial support. He purchased from an Ohio agent the homeowners and umbrella insurance policies for the Ohio house. Who owns the Ohio house?
The home is owned one-third by Robert Schill, the son, who's seeking coverage under these policies.
Right.
He's an insured. And by Mrs. Schill. James Schill owns no property anywhere. And this agent that procured this—
Anywhere? Did you say anywhere?
Anywhere. This agent who procured this policy, as a matter of fact, is someone who's been a lifelong Ohio friend of James, went to school with his children, knew that the two had this living arrangement together on a permanent and ongoing basis. And we look at James Schill's testimony. This is not someone who's going off to retire to Florida. People who retire to Florida, retire to Florida. And under this man's own testimony—
And people that move to Florida, move to Florida. You don't have to say that, you know, because you're a certain age, you can't work. And you know, he could work in any state in the country. He could work in multiple states in the country.
His preeminent headquarters remained here, where he works. He works 84 hours a week, back to back, for 168 hours a month. He did it then, he's doing it now, and by his own testimony, it's his intent to remain here in his lifelong domicile.
His intent is to return to Florida and to remain temporarily in Ohio for as long as it takes him to accomplish his business, but no more than what would trigger tax consequences because he wants to be domiciled in Florida.
His wife gave up her domicile in Ohio. She retired to Florida.
Do you think that the wife domiciles in Florida?
Excuse me?
Is his wife domiciled
in Florida?
That's
what he testifies to.
Pardon me?
That's what he testified to.
What do you think?
I think that's probably accurate.
Okay, so she's a domicile of Florida, and he's going to be a domicile of Ohio, and yet they both live at the same address in Florida. They go to the same church that they're registered parishioners. They pay their taxes there. They, they vote there. They have friends. They have a social life in Florida. And a couple days a month, he comes up to Ohio to conduct business.
It's not a couple of days a month. It's his preeminent headquarters here where all of his trusted advisors are. His attorneys for his trust, for his Ohio family
you
partnership.
You think that matters where his attorney is located?
I'm going on here. His accountants, his investment advisors.
But this is a trust-owned business, is it not?
He is the president and CEO.
Wait a minute, it's a trust-owned business.
I do not know that to be the case in full. He is the part owner of it. I know that the family trust owns a portion of it. The family trust is run out of the same Ohio home insured under the policy. But this man, they state in their merit brief that he comes here to check on his investments, and yet he's here actively running the day-to-day operations of his business here in Ohio. And the reason he's saying his domicile's in Florida is because he wants to avoid tax implications. Otherwise, he'd be saying, of course my son's covered under my Ohio policy because I live with him year-round. I did it then, I'm doing it now, and I plan on doing it for the rest of my life.
Counsel, would you agree that it's a factual question?
I would agree that the issue of having to abandon one's domicile, you have a set domicile and have to abandon it before it changes. The operative fact here is that he never abandoned it.
But is it a factual question?
Well, I think the court got it right when it ruled in our favor. At the very minimum, it is a factual question, but that leads to an even bigger problem because this case then has no broad applicability to anyone outside the confines of the unique policy language.
So you want an IA?
It should be dismissed as improvidently allowed on that basis. I just heard in the last argument here that the court is not concerned about the outcome of this case, but whether there's broad applicability. We have the same law that's applied since 1878. It was refined and honed in 1956 when the court decided what they concede in their brief is the proper domicile inquiry for abandoning one's domicile.
Well, I would like to stop you right there on abandonment. You said that he went to Florida in 1993 because he wanted to retire. When are you saying he failed retirement and started conducting business in Ohio again?
He never retired, and actually that's a very interesting question, Justice Kennedy, because in the record he's asked, Mr. Schill, when you formed your family partnership in 1997, why does it list an Ohio address there? And he says, because that was my address before I tried to change my domicile. So by his own testimony, by 1997, not 93, he still considers Ohio his domicile. He didn't retire for one day. He has owned businesses on a permanent and ongoing basis.
So if the 8th District, this is 8th District, right? Yeah, if it stands, then the test is not going to be what the intent of the individual is. People that are in similarly situated circumstances, and there are many in Ohio that have a residence outside of the state and maintain some assets in this state and keep under the radar as far as how much time they spend in Ohio, they're going to be advised to take your assets, take your businesses, and relocate them out of the state of Ohio. That's the end result of this policy that has been obviously put forth by the 8th District Court of Appeals.
I don't believe that to be the case. What the Court of Appeals says, it's not subjective intent alone. And since Corte, it's been an objective intent standard. Intent plus conduct. And here's the danger of saying subjective intent controls, and it's only known by me. Because then you can come back after the fact when
indicia. It's not just I'm keeping it a secret. There are so many factors, so many indicia of his intent, coupled with his affidavit stating his intent. I would agree with you if he didn't have all these other factors, including a wife who's domiciled in the state of Florida. I think you'd be on stronger grounds, but you can't just ignore the multitude of factors and say it's all trumped by the fact that he spends one-third of his time per month, but under a certain aggregate amount in the state of Ohio?
Well, then there are factors that are competing, and they need to be weighed by the fact finder, which is the only relief they requested when they sought jurisdiction here. It's what they argued in the Court of Appeals.
So it needs to go back to the trial court, and the trial court needs to look at intent here.
The trier of fact needs to look at the determine what is this man's domicile. But here's the danger with the subjective intent alone is people can come back after a contract is put in place and the intent is presumed to be in there, and they say, you know what, my subjective intent controls. I don't like what's in there. I can change it. I don't like what the legislature says I have to do about filing an affidavit. My intent trumps. My intent trumps everything, and it becomes no insurance industry person would want to come
in
here.
How many times can a person change domicile, in your view?
It depends on whether they have the coinciding of intent and conduct, okay? An objective standard. And when
so how many times can a person change domicile?
I couldn't give you an answer on that, but it's not like Mr. Mestel said to Justice O'Neill that he was domiciled here last night because he stayed here and he goes home tomorrow and he's not. That would be an incredibly unworkable standard.
I don't think that's what he said.
That's the implication I received from it.
Well, why wouldn't we look then at the indicia that the Chief Justice was suggesting, coupled with the intent of the individual, if in fact you agree that an individual may change domicile a number of times?
Well, to change domicile, they have to follow the rule, which is abandoning the first one with no intent to return to it. And that's the standard this court set forth in Hudson back in 1956. It's similar to what happened in Corte, where
they
said—
So is that the case that we should look at, Hudson?
Absolutely, and it only refines what was in Corte, which said the same thing. You have to remove yourself and remain there. And in Corte, we had infirmary inmates. There was no doubt they had been removed. They were there against their will.
Well, what do we do with an individual who is trying to remove himself from our state for tax purposes but return here?
Well,
you agree you can have more than one residence.
Well, first and foremost, he's got to follow what the taxing authority is saying. We know it's undisputed he didn't do that here. And the court
that's the critical flaw here, is that he didn't file a document with the tax department?
It's an affidavit where your subjective intent has to be reduced, but that says that if you only get
that
a presumed—
That affidavit trumps any other affidavit he files, even though the tax department is treating him as a Florida-domiciled individual.
I am merely stating what is under the statute, that it results in a presumed domicile of Ohio when you fail to do that. And that is one factor, and I bring it up because the court cited the wrong presumption in the trial court's opinion. It was corrected as one factor in the Court of Appeals, but again, the Court of Appeals went back to the standard from Corte.
Speaking
Hudson.
Of presumptions, I notice on the final line of the 8th District, they gave you final judgment. You're the appellee, and yet you're acknowledging you're going back to the trial court to start again?
I'm saying I believe the court got it right on a first line of defense here, that they followed that standard, that there was no abandonment here, because
I'm asking for the legal standard today, because they reversed the granting of summary judgment and then gave final judgment to the Spaeth family.
Right, and I believe
what
that,
does that mean?
I believe that the court got it right because there was no abandonment with the intent not to return. His intent is to be here for the rest
of
his
life. And I'd like to be clear and understand you perfectly. You say that as long as he doesn't file that affidavit, that he is domiciled in Ohio. So using that, therefore, 5747.24b1 would not apply to him, and he would be taxed as an Ohio resident for the past 20 years. Is that what you're saying?
The taxing authorities would have to determine that. I'm going by the plain meaning of the statute, that the presumptive domicile outside of Ohio only applies when the affidavit is filed.
I want to understand you clearly. So you're saying that since he didn't file this affidavit, he's domiciled in Ohio, and the exceptions under 5747.24b1 regarding the taxing code do not apply to him?
I don't have the authority to say that. Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't. I'm just merely stating that the statute says when you don't file the affidavit, there's a presumption that you're domiciled in Ohio, and that is one factor.
Thank you. Mr. Meistel, you have almost 3 minutes left.
I'd like to first point out this court's decision in the Houston case, Hudson, I apologize, was merely frankly, an entire quotation of the lower court's decision. So I don't believe it actually, with all respect due, and of course this court can tell me otherwise, I don't think it is actually an analytical decision from this court. It didn't consider Corte. It didn't consider any of the factors this court discussed in Corte. The tax statute that was talked about with Justice Kennedy, the tax statute has evolved. In 1993, when James Schill left, there was absolutely no requirement in the tax statute that he file an affidavit anywhere. In 2000, the statute was changed again. Again, absolutely no requirement that he file an affidavit with anyone. And by that point, he'd already left Ohio for 7 years. In 2007, I believe, is the next effective date, there was a change in the statute where they said, now you have to positively file an affidavit. Well, I believe that is respectfully unconstitutional, because it would mandate that every citizen in the state, in the United States, be deemed a domicile of Ohio unless they file an affidavit with the Ohio Secretary of State or its Department of Taxation.
If I understood Mr. Keefe's argument, his position is that James Schill did not abandon his domicile in Ohio because he continues and intends to return. And he argues to us there's no abandonment. That is one of the elements that we're to look at. What is your view of that argument?
Well, again, we have to look at intent. What was James Schill's intent in 1993?
Well, as Mr. Keefe would tell us, we know he didn't intend to abandon it because he continues to return every two weeks out of every month.
But abandonment of property is not the same thing as abandonment of your domicile, as the 11th District talked about in Warren versus Raven again, which I believe is a case that has taken some of
the Where is the evidence that your client has abandoned his Ohio domicile?
He let his Ohio driver's license lapse, got a Florida driver's license. He's voted in Florida since 1993. He moved there with his wife, took all of his personal property.
He owns
with
no
him,
property there.
But he took his personal property with him, okay? He has cars. He does own cars. The cars are registered and bought, titled in the state of Florida. They're not in Ohio. All his federal tax returns have been filed in Florida. He has not filed an Ohio state tax return. He doesn't file any city tax returns in Ohio. He has an Ohio family limited partnership through which he provides gifts to his children, et cetera, and owns this business. But that's property. The question is, what was his intent? In 93, and again, this goes to the issue of where do we start the analysis?
What does he drive when he's in Ohio?
He drives a Florida vehicle, which he has garaged in Ohio. It's registered with them. But the issue is where does the presumption start? In Langenham in the 8th District decision in 1982, as well as this court's decision in Coleman, we said this the question is where does the person currently reside? Where do they say they reside? Where do they say they're domiciled? That is the starting point for the analysis. It's not the fact that you're born in Ohio and now you have to prove to every state that you're to the state of Ohio you're no longer born here. I mean, you're no longer domiciled here. In 2008, he was domiciled in Florida. The Court of Appeals should have started the presumption then.
Counsel, I'm not sure it matters, but I've forgotten you. I asked you a question along these lines before. If there were a contractual dispute between your insured and your company, the law of what state would apply to resolving a contractual dispute?
I believe, again, I have not read per se every line of the contract, but I would presume that most policies that are written by an Ohio insured would say that this applies that the language is interpreted under Ohio law, which we're not asking for an interpretation under any other law.
That's, you say, generally the company would say we're an Ohio company, so you said an Ohio insured. I don't think you mean that, do you?
The insured under the policy, this umbrella policy covers him anywhere in the world, okay?
But you don't regard him to be an Ohio insured, do you?
No, he's an insured, period. He's a named insured under the policy.
I thought you called him an Ohio insured.
No, he is an insured, period. It's his policy. The question is the words legal residence of domicile as related to Robert, who is an Ohio domicile. The question is whether or not James Schill was domiciled in Ohio, and he hasn't been since 1993, and that's where the presumption is. And when you apply the presumption correctly, as this court has held for years, then you don't have a question of fact, because there is never a point in time after 1993 where the fact and the animus ever meet up again to change it back from Florida to any other state. And because of that, we believe that the trial court got it right here. The trial court said, we look at the intent, we look at the facts to support the intent, he's domiciled in Florida, end of story. The Court of Appeals said, we're going to ignore his intent, we're going to look at these couple facts, because even if you look at their 13 delineation of facts in their opinion, nine of them support a Florida determination.
Could you come back to the question I've asked, Justice French has asked, and that is, isn't this just almost completely fact-driven? And if it is, why are we here? It's one insured, one policy, one accident. What? And the outcome obviously is of direct interest to your company and to the parties here, but the next accident is going to be different.
As I started out, Your Honor, this decision that we believe this court should issue, a succinct opinion, will affect every domicile question the state of Ohio has.
Yeah, but you've already said the law, and that is clear since 1870 or 18, what was it? What year?
1878 is when court
1878.
And in 2009, this court accepted, or
so,
whether it was direct
so
appeal.
The law has been clear for 100 and how many years? 140.
But the 8th District's decision in this case could be looked at by the federal district courts to determine domicile diversity jurisdiction. The 8th District's decision in this case, if left unchanged, can determine voting rights.
Well, we can fix that without writing anything. We can simply improv it and say it's never to be cited.
Your Honor, so basically you would reverse the 8th District's decision without issuing a decision, which would clearly, if the court follows
No, I didn't say reverse. I said we could just improv it and say that their opinion is never to be cited. End of story.
Well, Your Honor, I would hope that when you have a clear precedent that this court has not just in 1878, it's in 1972 and it's in 2009, I would hope that the litigants here before the court would have the same effect or same ability to obtain
relief.
So
you want us to do error correction, which we say we don't do.
It's not error correction when the Court of Appeals completely ignores this court.
Well, it is error. Isn't that what error correction is? When we look at it and say the Court of Appeals got it wrong factually, error correction. And you're standing here saying since 1878, this court has understood domicile has a right. Everybody understands it, except the 8th District in this case didn't understand it.
It's not error correction when the court is pointing out succinctly what the law is. It's not error correction when the Court of Appeals ignores your decisions.
We write an opinion that says we meant it in 1878, we meant it in 1972
and in 2009.
And in 2009, and we mean it again today.
And you mean it in the sense that intent is the paramount inquiry, which starts the presumption, which we then take a look at the facts. Yes, at the end of the day, every case is decided on the facts. But
are you saying that it's important to give a roadmap here utilizing this case for analysis and then send it back?
That's exactly, Chief Justice, what we're asking.
Because the Court of Appeals, obviously, I mean, when you, according to your position here, produced an opinion that could be cited all over the state for authority with consequences that are unintended, especially within the area of what does someone who has assets in Ohio do with those assets when they intend to domicile someplace else? Do they uproot their assets from this state and take them with them.
I believe that's accurate. I believe that anyone reading this decision would have to determine if they move to Florida or any other state, Hawaii, Texas, that they can do nothing. They can't even visit, maybe to visit their children ever again, because the fact that they're born in Ohio, they still have children reside here, could be indicia of the fact that they
never abandoned
their
domicile. Counsel, you make it sound like it's easy, but after a half hour of oral argument and reading an awful lot of briefs, I don't know what James' intent was as to regards to domicile. I think we're back to Justice French, aren't we? Isn't it a factual? Because the 8th District Court of Appeals apparently treated it as a de novo summary judgment proceeding, correct?
They did, which I believe.
And they granted summary judgment to those folks.
I believe, Your Honor, though, this is a declaratory judgment action. I'm not sure the 8th District could have done that technically. The trial court issued a declaratory judgment. The issue should have been manifest weight, but that's not really before the court because it's not been assigned as, well, you don't assign
it
as.
But it is before the court because the 8th District overturned a summary judgment motion.
Well, they overturned a summary judgment motion in a declaratory judgment action, which then raises the question as to what the appropriate standard of review should have been. But it's not a fact issue because you're dealing with a legal presumption. And if you have the legal presumption stated correctly in this case, which is in 2008, where was James Schill domiciled?
No, I must disagree because you are asking this court to clarify and or overturn an 1878 ruling, and yet you can't tell me this morning what James' intention was in 19 or 2000, whatever year it was.
Well, the record's clear what his intention was. His intention was always to be domiciled in Florida since 1993.
That's what he said.
That's what he said in his deposition. It's pages 80 and 81 of the appellate.
But he reversed that. He reversed that. He said I flunked.
No, he didn't. He said he didn't. He flunked retirement. That doesn't mean I flunked moving to Florida.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
We'll take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decision. Thank you very much. Marshall, will you adjourn court, please, for a recess?